Thank you very much, Tanyan. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPC call on the 31st of January 2012. On the call today, we have Michaela Nalen, Kevin Erdman, Barbara Knight, Mikey O'Connor, James Bladel, Avi Doria, Rob Villeneuve, Matt Serlin, Chris Chaplow, and Roy Dykes. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrin. We have apologies from Paul Diaz, Philip Corwin, Angie Graves, Rob Mountain, Jonathan Tenenbaum, and Zahid Jamil. And as for every week, Simonetta Batayga might join us late. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IRTPC Working Group call for January 31st, 2012. And per our standard operating procedure, I wanted to ask if anyone had any reviews or updates or changes to their statements of interest. Okay. And the second item is to ask anyone if they have any additions or changes to the proposed agenda, which is listed on the Adobe chat and was circulated on the mailing list. If you have any items you'd like to change there, please speak now. And silence is consent in both of those regards, so thank you for that. This call is effectively dedicated to the review of the comments received and the stakeholder group statements received. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and Marika could probably help me here, we are probably... It would not be unrealistic to think that we could complete the review of these comments during this call, but let's see how far we can go, and let's see where the conversations take us. So, Marika, can you help me and help the group here remember where we left off last week?
Yeah, this is Marika. So basically, I think where we left off is comment 5. You already see some notes in there, but those were added based on the initial run-through we had. I just would like to encourage everyone to review actually the other notes, you know, when I send out these updates, just to make sure that it tracks the working group conversations accordingly, and also note that I've tried to incorporate in each of these lines as well, the recommended action based on the conversations we have had. So if people have any concerns or any comments on you know, what I've added there, you know, please let me know, and I can make changes accordingly. So basically, I think where we left off is comment 5.
Thank you. And had we completed comment 5, or we were kind of in the midst of it, or I think we probably completed it.
As said, the notes that are there basically come from the initial run-through we had, so I don't know if that's indeed, you know, sufficient or whether there's anything else the working group would like to discuss. I mean, as you know, as it says there, you know, some remark that it would be helpful to receive further input on why this denial reason is actually applied by registrars. So a recommended action could then be indeed to, you know, survey registrars or request further input, or I don't know if there's a discussion that you would like to have now already on getting some input on that question, or whether there are any other elements that need to be considered with regard to this specific comment.
Okay, so it's probably worthwhile to spend a few minutes then revisiting number 5 and making sure we have that one buttoned up before we move on to charter question B. Or if there's any new charter question A relevant comments that folks would like to tack on before we move on. So charter question 5, if you could read that for us, it looks like it's a registry comment.
Yes, comment 5 relates to charter question A. In relation to reason for denial number 9, since some transfer disputes are raised as a result of a registrar's practice of locking down a domain, when modifications are made to the registrant details, the registry stakeholder group recommends that additional clarification be added to specifically state that registrars are prohibited from restricting transfers for 60 days after changes to registrant details. To the extent that a new policy is developed to address the change of control function, then that policy could also address any specific restrictions, impacts that a change of registrant details would have on inter-registrar transfer.
Okay, thank you. And I just posted reason for denial 9 in the chat, just in case there were some folks who were unclear or, you know, don't refer to these necessarily by numbers. we'll open up the queue then. Any other comments or thoughts on this? I think that we did discuss that reason for denial 9 and possibly also relating to reason for denial 8 were often used by registrars to kind of establish at least an initial sponsorship of a domain name, whether it's first created or it's transferring in from another registrar. These are transfer prohibition periods or cooling off periods, usually about 60 days. And the thinking here is that there would be a the change of control function may have its own items, may or may not have its own moratoriums built into it, and therefore may or may not be subject to reason for denial 9 and reason for denial 8. I would want to point out, however, as a representative of a registrar, that the particular practice that's discussed in the registry comment is predicated on reason for denial 6, which is it's slightly different. That is express written objection to the transfer by the transfer contact. So I don't know if I think Barbara's on the call. Maybe I don't know if that's a material change to the to this comment, or if that's or if that applies equally to reason for denial 6. And I hate to put you on the spot, Barbara, but if you can clarify, that would be great.
That's okay, James. This is Barbara. I think it probably does apply more perhaps to 6, which actually isn't under discussion, but we do get questions at the registry level many times. If it's a request for enforcement that's specifically indicating that a domain is not being allowed to transfer, a lot of times they're indicating that it's because there have been, you know, perhaps a change of registrant data. So that's what we were trying to address here. Does that help?
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I couldn't mute button off. And you know, I'll go ahead and speak now on behalf of the registrar. We have this practice, the 60-day transfer lock after changes to registrant information, and we do base that on reason for denial 6. It is in our assessment, a very effective anti-hijacking practice because, as we've noted, that changing the information in those three fields, the registrant name, registrant organization, and registrant's email address, can be a significant security vulnerability. And we are looking at some changes that were recommended coming out of IRTPD, which is a previous instance of this the transfer working group series, which modifies reason for denial 6 significantly. I think in some respects, if comment number 5 is addressing reason for denial 6, that might be something that is actually going to be changing here fairly soon. But we have the chair of IRTPB, Mr. McKelly Nalon is first in the queue, so I'll turn it over to him. McKelly.
You're kind of buttering me up with that, aren't you? Just for the record, that James was speaking in his own personal capacity as an employee of a specific registrar, as opposed to speaking for all registrars, just so we're clear.
Correct, and I think I stated maybe not clearly.
I'm just emphasizing, James, I'm not arguing with you. I just want to emphasize the fact that your comments are specific to your own employer's position.
Correct.
So, whereas my comment would be, I understand and appreciate and empathize and sympathize and everything else with James's position. I think this is the root problem that we're trying to deal with in this working group. Well, one of the root problems is the fact that at the moment there is no concept within ICANN policy to deal with the change of control of a domain name. And I think that needs to be rectified, because We see stupidly complicated arguments which cost us time, money, and mainly headaches and the money parts that cause is what gets me. If I'm selling a domain name for €6, I really don't need to have €500 of legal costs trying to sort out some stupid dispute between two third parties. Anyway, I'll let Chris go. Thanks.
Well, before
thanks,
I say...
Thanks, Kelly, and I'm sorry. Go ahead. I did want to apologize if I was not emphatic enough that I was speaking in capacity of the registrar. So a registrar, not all registrars. Go ahead, Chris.
Thank you. Chris Jaffer speaking. Before I say what I was going to say, with that marvelous lead-in from McKelly, it is true that I sometimes, as a business person, I'm surprised about how much work registrars can do to sort out problems for the sake of a €6 financial gain. So let me just say that on record from the business side, in personal capacity, I suppose, not the business constituency. What I was just going to say was actually a story just from I was having dinner with somebody else the other night who just bought a domain from somebody, and the domain was registered with GoDaddy. It had been, the other party had opened a GoDaddy account on his behalf, pushed the domain into it, and then sort of said, well, there's your domain. And he found himself, I won't say caught in the 60-day lock, because he didn't really know anything about it. He was just telling me about this 60-day lock. And so I know a little bit about that. So that was, and of course, he hadn't accepted any terms and conditions of anybody. He was able, and that's what I'm right in saying, aren't I? He was able to change the DNS. So for him, it was a bit academic, and to be quite honest, he wasn't too bothered about it. So I just thought I'd share that with the group.
Thank you, Chris. Barbara was in the queue, but she dropped her hand. So, I see her comment in the chat that McKelly summed up her comments. So I just wanted to add just a few things, and this is, again, emphatically, for the position of a registrar and just the registrar that I am employed by, not all registrars. But the first thing is that Marika has posted a new language for Reason for Denial 6 that was the output of the IRTPB working group that has been approved by the council, I believe is now on its way to the ICANN board and will probably be implemented sometime soon, that addresses some of the meat and potatoes of this issue head on. And so I think that, one of the working group comments here is that, we would love to maybe take a look at this issue in the context of the new policy, which we probably will be expecting sometime around the time we all get on the plane for Costa Rica. The second point I wanted to make was that I think that McKelly's correct that this is one of the major holes, and I think Chris touched on it as well, is that in the current change of control environment or in the absence or the void of this function in ICANN, it would be no problem, for example, for me to create an offensive or infringing domain name and then go and just assign that to someone I wanted to harass. Like if I had some sort of a falling out with McKelly and I wanted to cause him trouble. So I could just go and put his contact information and his name. And as Chris pointed out in his example, McKelly didn't necessarily agree to accept the domain name or even to agree to any terms and conditions. It's just now is suddenly associated with his name, and I think that we've seen this done in criminal circles as well. So there's this void in this informality, and I think that the industry has done very well in innovating around that, but it could possibly use some help from the policy side in clarifying what a change of control looks like, what it looks like, what are the required elements, which party's authorization need to be obtained and when, and overall what a process like that would look like. I don't think we can hope to generate something perfect that would eliminate all of these issues, but I think we can go a long way to closing these loopholes. I knew it. I used McKelly as an example, and now here comes the blowback. McKelly.
No, I was just actually going to go back to actually cite an example, which has nothing to do with transfers. but all to do with, how can I say it, unauthorized use of contact details in Domain Whois. About 18 months ago, we found ourselves being, well, we weren't sued, we were almost sued by Satanta Sports, who are a TV channel that do sports, oddly enough, and the GAA, who are the Gaelic Athletic Association, who, oddly enough, deal with Gaelic games like hurling and football and other Irish sports. And all because somebody had registered a domain name, can't remember through which registrar, doesn't matter, and without our knowledge or permission, had put our contact details into Whois. So as far as the affected parties were concerned, the domain was ours. We had no knowledge of it. It had nothing to do with us, but Whois never lies. Sure, Whois is wonderfully, what's the word I'm looking for? Reliable. And, you know, forcing registrars to validate Whois and check that the Whois looks is valid will, of course, avoid all problems, including people using contact details without permission, of course. Logically, I hope you get the sarcasm. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. Sarcasm doesn't translate well, I'm sure, in transcription, but I think we get your point.
That's why I said I hope you get the sarcasm.
Okay, well, I think we've covered this one fairly extensively. We've exhausted the queue here. We've heard from a lot of individuals and some fairly good examples of why this is a problem. I think one response that we should note, Marika, with Barbara's permission, is that question 4 dealing with reason for denial 8 and question 5 dealing with reason for denial 9, both, especially question 5, also touch on reason for denial 6, and that we should view any deliberations or recommendations from this working group in context of the new reason for denial 6 language, which will be implemented later this spring. Barbara, go ahead.
This is Barbara. I'm being formal, and I'm saying, yes, I do agree with that. That's fine. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Okay, so closing up of discussion point number 5, and then noticing that that is it for the hardest of our 3 charter questions, the most difficult or most complex charter question A. Does anyone else have anything they would like to add on the topic of charter question A before we move on to the next section? Okay, thanks. The queue is clear. Let's move on to reason, or I'm sorry, Kelly, I didn't leave you enough time. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I'm multitasking as usual. Sorry about that, James. Are you asking for comments in relation to charter question A in general, or in relation to the feedback we've received on charter question A?
I think in general, in that, you know, we have these comments, we have now discussed those 5 comments received, and that we have proposed responses there captured by Marika in red, as well as the one we just discussed in charter question 5. Is there anything missing or anything you'd like to add to our review?
Well, I'll just throw this out here anyway. Just for the record, I think that the lack of a change of control is something that needs to be addressed, personally. But I think it doesn't matter what comes out the far end, be it a codifying of a lock of some kind or the codifying of a lack of a lock of some kind. But at least can we, you know, discuss this to death and agree or disagree, but let's at least make sure that we've given us ample discussion and we've got a good, wide, broad, comprehensive, what other words am I looking for, representative range of feedback from as many parties who could be affected. And by affected, I mean anybody who ever registers a bloody domain name, basically. Because I think the lack of this change of control leads to a whole range of issues, and there's no reason why we cannot have a change of control function, in my mind, I mean, the details are something that people who are better writing documents than me can sort out, that can coexist with other activities, be that aftermarket or whatever. There's no reason why you can't have the two. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. And while you were speaking there, I wanted to note for the transcript that a number of green check marks appeared in the Adobe room. So I think that there is, if not full consensus, there is a strong consensus building for what you're saying is that the absence of this policy or the absence of this function within ICANN policy is a problem. And it causes a lot of businesses and individuals a lot of frustration, heartache, and expended resources trying to cope, is that a good word, cope with the absence of something like this, and that we could possibly, you know, do this industry a huge favor by closing some of those voids. Well, thank you. And if there are no other questions, then I would ask Marika to move on to charter question B, comment received number 6.
So this is Marika. So the comment 6 relating to charter question B from GoDaddy. Practical limits on the effective term of a form of authorization should be considered. 60 days would be a reasonable time frame. To inform its work, the IRTP Part C working group should gather and consider scenarios in which a registrar receives an FOA from the registrant but does not submit the transfer request to the registry.
Okay, I have a comment here in a personal slash registrar capacity, but I'll put myself at the end of the queue and open up to comments. Mikey.
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I just want to support this idea and offer the suggestion that maybe 60 days is even a little too long, because it seems like FOA is a transaction that's pretty tied to a transfer event. I don't think I'm taking Bob's name in vain. I see that he's not on the call. Bob and Mom Mountain and I had a conversation about FOAs and the aftermarket. I note that I think Simonetta is not on the call yet either. And the issue that Bob was raising with me was that the aftermarket's current process really depends on a long FOA period so that they can affect the transfers at an indeterminate time in the future. And my suggestion was that rather than having an extremely long FOA interval where the domain is essentially released in a way, why not introduce the notion of an FOA renewal or even an FOA auto-renewal that a customer who's using the aftermarket could opt in on, and thus the aftermarket could still essentially have that release, but it would be specific to a customer who wants it rather than the other way around, which is right now everybody is essentially vulnerable to an unexpired FOA. So I think that there's a way to navigate through this in a way that we can accomplish the goal of tightening this up a bit without paralyzing the aftermarket. And I just wanted to sort of rattle all that off because I noticed that Bob and Simonetta are both not on the call today and wanted to express their, at least Bob's concern. I don't know whether Simonetta shares it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mikey. Anyone else care to weigh in on this topic? Michele?
Actually, yeah, I do. Oh, God, that's hardly comes as a surprise, though, does it? It's heartening to hear support for a short FOA from Mikey. I'm actually really glad that he gets that concept, why a couple of us identify this as an issue, and thank you, Mikey. I also am conscious of the fact that, you know, for that as Mikey said, some aftermarket companies work on the basis of the FOA kind of having this ridiculous long expiry and everything else. However, as I said, with relation to the change of control, surely that's a question of how the policy is worded. Because at the moment, you have this Icon-esque FOA, and you'd swear to God it was the only possible way to agree anything between two parties. Now, I know that's going to come as a shock and a horror, and it's going to shock some people, but, you know, ICANN, it does not override contract law as far as I'm concerned. If I've got a contract with my customer and I'm in Ireland and they're in Ireland or in Europe, then that's going to have a hell of a lot more weight in an Irish court than something from some random organization in California. So, I mean, the fact that the FOA is there and it works in a particular way is fine, but maybe it's time to have a look at how the FOA system currently works, and maybe there is an appropriate way to actually deal with this in such a manner that both those of us who are primarily dealing with, you know, SMEs, or small businesses who just want to move domains around the place, and those people who want to transact and buy and sell domain names in an aftermarket, they can coexist too. I just think, you know, there's no reason why, in my view, you can't have both if you word the policy correctly. Thank you.
Thank you, Michele. Good comments. And I'll just go ahead and weigh in here on behalf of GoDaddy, and we submitted this comment. I understand we recognize that some aftermarket systems require or would prefer, I think, a longer or more indefinite open-ended form of authorization. I think that we have identified this has the potential to be a vulnerability. I think that the time frame, 60 days, is sufficient. I think we can debate valid reasons and justifications why it should be shorter or longer, but 60 days aligns it with all of the other cooling off periods, grace periods, prohibitions, locks, whatever we want to call it. So I think that helps to just kind of establish some consistency. The only other point that wanted to make on this one here was that I think that having some limitations on FOA can be done in such a way that it's not incompatible with current aftermarket practices. I think Mikey put out a couple of ideas, for example, the auto-renewing FOA or the opt-in to an auto-renewing FOA. I think if I'm paraphrasing what I heard Michele saying, that maybe rather than having a universal form that everyone enters into with an FOA, ICANN could proscribe that each registrar have its own FOA so long as it complied with certain required elements, but then that would make it a little more compatible with local law, although I think that's possibly a recipe for a lot of confusion. And then finally, the only other part here was just that I think in our thinking with the aftermarket was that if someone listed a domain name for sale and had not received any interest or offers within 60 days, then that would be not only an opportunity for the aftermarket service provider to renew the FOA, but also to re-engage that particular customer and find out, you know, what's going on with that name. Is it not being categorized appropriately, or is it not priced appropriately, or whatever? I mean, these are business decisions, but I think the case could be made to the aftermarket providers that having a regular check-in for those customers who are not seeing a lot of activity on their listings would possibly be a good thing. So I'll drop my hand for there and go to Michele. And then Mikey, afterwards.
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, yeah, James does raise a very valid point. You don't want to end up in a situation where, you know, an attempt to fix one problem causes a whole range of other problems. So if every single registrar was able to have a separate FOA, I can see that causing more problems than anything else. What I was trying to get at was more along the lines of just, you know, maybe revising, reviewing, tweaking how the entire FOA thing is done in such a manner, potentially, that, you know, let's say, for example, if I am, as a domainer, domain investor, depending on what, you know, call me what you will, if I want to put a few domain names with a marketplace and have an FOA with them, you know, tight for much longer than 60 days, that I should have the option to do that. I'm not saying that every single FOA is going to be different, but if I, as a registrant, want to enter into that kind of agreement with a registrar, then I should be able to do that. There was another point. Sorry. Can't remember now. I had it. I've lost it. I'll cede to Mikey. Thanks.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mikey.
Thanks, James. I just want to react a little bit to your last thought, James. I think that one of our goals should probably be a pretty sparse conversation about the FOA. I wouldn't want to get into a place where we're suggesting to an aftermarket provider that they ought to talk to their customer on any given interval. One of the business practices that's fairly prevalent, although this is, I am speaking in total ignorance because I've never done this, but my understanding is that domainers will list domains with an aftermarket provider, sometimes for years, in hopes that it will sell. Since those names appear in the, quote, premium domain listings on other registrars. And so the expectation on the part of the domain holder and the aftermarket provider is that some of these domains will sit in that inventory for a very long time before they sell. And I wouldn't want this policy process to get to that level of detail in the conversation. I think that's something that if we can write the policy in a way that my point to Bob was that it would be helpful if there was a way to use automation to solve the problem that the aftermarket providers have rather than trying to build it into policy and then build policy that's sparse and clear enough that it's easy to automate too. But then stop. I think we get into complicated areas if we start to talk about how often aftermarket providers ought to talk to their customers. Thanks.
Thanks, Mikey. And just to be clear, I was kind of using that as an example, not necessarily recommending that be language that would be included anywhere in the recommendations or the report, just more part of our deliberation. It looks like McKelly has remembered his point from before, so go ahead, McKelly.
Yeah, I'll keep this brief. It's unfortunate that neither Bob or Simonetta, I normally don't have problems pronouncing her name, aren't on the call today. I mean, one of the things that, you know, Mikey touched on, I think James might have touched on as well. I mean, you could easily end up in a situation where a domain is listed on multiple marketplaces and sits there for a very, very long time. I think, you know, it's something that it would be helpful to get some feedback from the people in the aftermarket as to see how they realistically handle this. But, I mean, you know, domain names change hands. They expire. People re-register them. I have seen situations arise across various marketplaces where I would go to add a domain name to an account to discover it was already on somebody else's account, but, you know, it just had never been cleaned down when it expired or changed hands. So, you know, it's just something that, you know, it'd be useful to know how they're handling those kind of things, I think. Thanks.
Thanks, McKelly. And since we typically discuss domain name life cycles in one-year intervals as they auto-renew, it's interesting that, one to 10-year life cycles, it's interesting that in some cases the FOA is being held open longer than a typical life cycle of a domain name. So, I think if I can just kind of bring us back to a conclusion here, it seems like there's this understanding that time-limiting an FOA is not necessarily incompatible with aftermarket practices, and that it sounds like we're in agreement that the aftermarket, the needs of the aftermarket for a long FOA, as long as possible, or perhaps even indefinite, is not necessarily shared by all of the individuals, the vast majority of whom are not participating in those types of activities. So that it seems like that we're coming down on the side that perhaps we should institute some limitations on the time frame of an expiration expiration date, or best if used by date for an FOA, and that the language could be constructed in such a way that the aftermarket folks could still continue their existing practices. Comment number seven is essentially identical to comment number six. However, it leaves out one key thing, which is it does not recommend a specific time frame, and instead defers to, in this particular case, defers to the registrar community. And I believe it might have been Avery that in our first run through these comments pointed out that it really should be more of a cross-community, multiple stakeholder approach to determining that time period rather than just registrars. And I think I, as a registrar, agree with that. So unless someone has a substantive comment on number seven that feels that perhaps that I've been too hasty in saying that it's essentially the same as comment number six, were there any other comments, questions, or thoughts on this subject, charter question B, whether or not FOA should be indefinite or have some reasonable time limits established for their use? Okay. Well, as we suspected, once we got past charter question A, these things would go relatively quickly. So moving on to charter question C. Marika, if you could start us off by reading comment number eight, please.
Of course. This is Marika. So comment eight from GoDaddy. GoDaddy anticipates that this might become a greater burden for all registrars with new GTLDs when hundreds of new GTLDs are active in the DNS. A move to uniformly employ IANA ID numbers in GTLD registry systems would therefore be favored to the extent practical.
Thank you. And, just introducing charter question C, I think this is something that I don't want to presume, but I think in the general case, this is something that is really between registries and registrars. It's very much an under-the-hood technical operation as opposed to something that has a direct impact on other stakeholders. The reason I say that is because, in my opinion, this is how we identify ourselves when we're communicating both verbally and technically with the registry. So, I don't know, this might seem pretty dry and actually kind of boring, I think, to folks in other stakeholder groups, but, I'm open to being surprised. Michele, go ahead and comment on this one, please.
I would almost 100% agree with you. Almost. But I'd take it a bit step further. I would actually see it as being, if there was more uniformity in this particular area, it would allow us as registrars to offer a better level of customer service and remove some of the confusion in the messaging that we are obliged at present to present to registrants, in other words, our customers. Because, for example, in the last week, I've had a number of emails into my inbox saying that a particular domain name was being transferred from one registrar to another. We were the losing registrar, which was fine. That didn't bother me. But I had absolutely no idea who the gaining registrar was. I couldn't see that because all I got was the registrar ID. And there is no easy way for me to take that registrar ID and check it against anything. I have no way of knowing who the hell that registrar is. The only way I could do it might be to use, I don't know, maybe Google it, and maybe somebody somewhere has accidentally posted that ID somewhere in public. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'd love to hear from a registrant as to why they think this is a bad idea. So I'm all ears. Thanks.
I had a thought, but I'll save it until after Mikey. Go ahead.
Thanks, James. I'm on the bus. The thing I wanted to say is that I think that the stake that registrants have in this is quite a bit along the lines of what Michaela just said, which is that we as customers also have a stake in reduced errors, more accurate transfers, easier customer support, because we're the ones on the receiving end. So I think that when we do our write-up, we should not write this up just as something to take care of the needs of registries and registrars, because really we as customers benefit just as much from an improvement like this.
Thanks, Mikey, and that's an excellent point and something I overlooked, that while it's maybe difficult to draw a straight line between this issue and the benefits to registrants, there's always the benefit of just cleaning up the overall transaction environment so that there are fewer errors, fewer confusion, less vulnerability to people to be manipulated by those in the know. So I just wanted to close off with a couple of quick points here. I put myself in the queue, and this is just speaking in a personal capacity. The first one to Michele is, you know, it did occur to me, Michele, that you could wait until after the dominium is transferred and then do a Whois lookup and see which registrar that was and then build your table over time. But I agree, in the absence of a secret decoder ring, it's impossible to tell that on the spot, which really, in some ways, raises an interesting question. Suppose that you had visibility into transfer out requests and knew which registrar was requesting that. Would that, let me see here. Suppose that a registrar wanted to have a different set of or interpretation of transfer policy for one competitor versus another. If I had it out for Michele because we had some dispute somehow, and I wanted to see all the transfers that were going to him, does this somehow obfuscate those transactions such that I cannot discriminate against transfers that were going out to Michele? I mean, that's just, I don't know the answer. It's just something that just popped into my head while Michele was speaking. The second thing I wanted to point out is that, I think one of the key elements of our comment here is that we can live with the situation today that with one registry, our ID number is ABC123, and with the next registry it's XYZ987. And, you know, these are computers. They can handle these things. These systems are fairly sophisticated. But it's just going to become more and more tedious and unmanageable in the new landscape, which we expect to be populated by a larger number of registries. And then thirdly, I just wanted to offer up here, I know we only have one registry representative on the call, but I see another other registrar representatives who are a little quiet here, and I wanted to give them an opportunity to weigh in on this issue, charter question C, and see if there was if they had any strong opinions one way or the other. Thinking now, if, you know, we can encourage Matt and Rob and some of the other guys to raise their hand. It worked. Okay, so Matt raised his hand. He's in the queue, but he is behind.
I preemptively raised my hand because I knew.
Awesome.
I knew you were going to call me out.
You know, sometimes
you always pick on Sterling. I think it should be encouraged.
You know, sometimes you have to go and shake the tree somehow.
I knew my time was coming. No, thanks, James. And I think, by and large, I agree with GoDaddy's comment. I think, and I guess Mikey's as well, actually, for everyone's benefit, registrar, registry, end user, ICANN, to be able to use a uniform ID across all registries really makes a lot more sense. And you're right, Barbara's the only one on the call, but I can't imagine that would create a huge obstacle for the registry operators.
Guys, that's twice you said that Barbara's the only registry on the call. That's factually incorrect.
Okay.
Is that all done?
Roy is also on the call. He may be very, very quiet, but he's also on the call, and he's from Newstar.
Yeah, no, you're right. He is. Okay, so maybe
good
we'll
point.
Pick on Roy next. But I don't
think
imagine
we should pick on Roy. I think we should pick on Roy, but that's just me.
I don't imagine that would create a huge headache for the registries to implement. And if we're going to do something like that, James, to your point, we should probably do it while there's a smaller number of registries before there's several hundred of them.
Okay, agreeing that. Michele, you're next, and then I wanted to point out that Rob Golding posted something interesting in the chat box as well, so after Michele's comment, we'll raise that as well.
Okay, and oh look, Roy's put up his hand. Woohoo. The thing I was going to say, I mean, to James's thing, you know, if it was there, would it lead to registrars doing anything special? Well, no, because if you see a spike in transfers out to a particular registrar ID, you probably will go sit down, work out who the hell it is, and try and work out if it's something you need to worry about. So, to answer your question, no, it wouldn't have any impact. Under the contract, there's no way for us or anybody else to treat any registrar any differently. You know, we have to allow transfers to flow in and out, you know, based on our normal business procedures and processes. I mean, there are certain things, let's say, for example, with respect to who is access, you know, if a particular registrar starts pounding your who is server and you have no idea that it's legit, that these are legitimate requests, then, you know, you might end up blocking them accidentally, but that's more down to network security than anything else. Thanks. I see to Roy, who's going to speak for the first time on this call. Woo! Go, Roy!
Hello, everybody. And for those of you who don't know me, just a real quick background on myself. I've been here at Newstar for just over 8 months. Before then, I spent 2.5 years leading the core product management, or core services of product management at Network Solutions. So I have a little bit more of experience on the hosting, email, and security side than I do on the domain side, but quickly coming up to speed. Relative to the IANA IDs, I need to do a little bit more research. I know that Newstar and also Afilias do use a proprietary ID and not the IANA ID. So in my understanding, just from the surface, which is why I need to do more research, is that it's a non-trivial element to move over to just the IANA IDs. But let me do some more research and try and come back with some more substantive comments on this particular item next week.
Thank you, Roy. And actually, a question for Roy and for Barbara. If you guys could maybe perhaps work together offline and for next week give us an idea of what the impact of this proposed change would mean for registries. I think that was something hopefully we were looking for in the registry stakeholder group comments, and I don't know if there's anything conclusive in there, so maybe that would be a thought. Is how difficult is this? How much would it involve change? What sort of unforeseen consequences, I guess, are we missing in our discussions? But thanks, Roy, and welcome. And I see that Michele is here, but as usual, we will defer to Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to point out, as I did in the chat as well, that there's actually further input from the registry stakeholder group in comment 13 relating to this issue, and that talks about why you need two registries. And if I understand Roy correctly, it's Newstar and Afilias are using IANA IDs, and there they do point out that there has to be a there would need to be a compelling reason for these registries to transition to the use of IANA IDs, as the level of effort involved would be significant given that all systems would be impacted. So there's already some feedback in that specific comment which the group might want to consider in relation to this discussion.
Thank you, Marika. Good point. Michele?
Yeah, this is just very, very...
Last comment for today.
Woohoo! Now, this is very, really, really brief, and it's great to have fresh blood in the working group, and it's great that you're speaking up, and long may this continue. Because the more you guys, the rest of you people speak up, then the more, you know, those of us who just yabber who talks the wall can, you know, stay quiet. Just Roy, just as by way of clarification, we're not asking to replace a proprietary ID with the IANA ID. That is not what is being asked at all. What we would like to see, and somebody else can jump in and disagree with me if I get this wrong, is that that whatever ID either include the IANA ID or be based off the IANA ID in a manner which is parsable, machine parsable, basically. So that, let's just say for argument's sake, our IANA ID is 1448. Our internal affilius or new star ID is Zcell1. That would morph into something which includes 1448, and if it wants to have some kind of proprietary a new star thing, then so be it. But the 1448 bit would be something that, you know, other registrars be looking and go, oh, 1448, that's Black Knight. Thanks.
Thanks, McKelly. I would point out that while that's an excellent thought and something that we should consider and capture in this, that the strict literal reading of our charter question is proposing a replacement, at least in my interpretation. It says something about registries use IANA IDs for registrars rather than proprietary IDs. So it seems to me that they were proposing a replacement, but I agree that there could be, especially for incumbent registries, could be using a system that you propose where it contains the ID and then requiring the use of IANA IDs for new registries as they come online.
Well, James, that's part. If the wording gives that impression, then that's Marika and I may have maybe slightly at fault for that. I think the two of us kind of drafted some of that wording, I think. I could be wrong. Marika might correct me.
This actually comes from the initial IRGP drafting team that came up with the list of items. So I don't think, for this one at least, I don't think we're to blame.
Okay, thank you. We have just a few minutes left. I see Mikey is in the queue. We'll let him speak, and then after that, we'll just kind of wrap up the meeting. So take it away there, Mikey.
This is Mikey. I think that there are ways to rephrase this. For example, one option might be to say that the process could be streamlining by a requirement that registrars include IANA IDs in transactions rather than replace. And that could even be, I'm worried that what's being proposed might cause all registry databases to renumber existing processes, which I have never done this in the registry space, but I did a lot of work in manufacturing companies. We tried really hard to avoid renumbering all the parts in a manufacturing operation. That is a huge process. And rather than specifying how that ID gets included, maybe we just leave it as an implementation detail to say, you know, you can, if you want, you can renumber all your IDs to include it, or you could include it as another field in the transaction or something. But I am very sympathetic to Rob's point, which is if we're forcing a registry to renumber the IDs of all of their transactions, that is a big deal. So I think we need to be a bit careful in how we frame our suggestions there. That's it. See you.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. And I agree that we need to be clear whether we're discussing replacement or augmentation. And I think we can also, I don't know if this was said or if it was just something I was thinking about, but we could also have slightly different implementation guidelines or requirements for incumbent registries that exist now versus those that are, you know, the coming wave that we expect, which is where I think we anticipate the operational challenges will be with the status quo. So with that comment, will note that we are now, I believe, on charter question 9 with, looks like, about 4 or 5 more to go. Apologies that we did not get through this review tool today. It was probably a little too ambitious on my part. Sorry for that. The next meeting will be same time, same channel, 1 week from today. And we will wrap up this this discussion then. So great deliberations and discussions, everyone.
And domain names in our January sale.
That's not coming from me. There we go. Okay. So,
how lovely.
Yeah, I don't have such an effective radio voice. So, anyway, thanks, everyone. Have a great week. Please view the mailing list, and if you have any thoughts, don't hesitate to contribute them. I think the mailing list has been a little quiet lately, but that's just a personal editorial. So, thank you, and have a great week.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
Good call.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tanya.